You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, President Biden says vaccines for kids will be up and running by next week. The CDC just authorized Pfizer's vaccine for kids as young as 5. It's an announcement some parents have been waiting for. Others don't know how to handle. Get answers to your questions about kids and the shot. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a new report from the Federal Trade Commission shows that cigarette sales increased in 2020 by $800 million. It's the first time in 20 years that sales have gone up from the previous year. The latest findings also include new data on flavors, especially menthol, and smokeless tobacco products. So did the pandemic drive some of us to smoke? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you or someone in your life a smoker? Have you quit a long time ago or recently? Has the pandemic influenced you or someone you know's tobacco use? Are you seeing more people smoking in your area? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Doug Jorenby is the Director of Clinical Services for the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. He's a professor of medicine for the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Jorenby, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me back.
Well, 20 or so years of declines in cigarette sales. Were you surprised to see this uptick?
It certainly stands out in the curve of consumption over, as you said, the last two decades. At the same time, I think we have to take it with a grain of salt, given that it was less than half a percentage point of an increase. And of course, the circumstances around pretty much everything in 2020 were extraordinary in all the senses of that term. But it's definitely something that bears close attention in the coming year.
Right. Not a huge increase, but up when you'd prefer to see continued down. Could you talk about some of the circumstances of the pandemic that may have slowed the decline in our smoking rates?
Sure. And, it's important to note that the Federal Trade Commission is just looking at the number of cigarettes sold. That's what they're talking about. But it does not take a whole lot of imagination to look at, I think, two factors that are very relevant to all of that. One, of course, for just about everybody, 2020 was a remarkably stressful and disruptive year. And of course, if there's one thing that we know about people who regularly use tobacco products, cigarettes or smokeless, for a lot of them, it's their go-to when they're coping with stress. And there was more than enough stress to go around in 2020. So the idea that intake, that use would go up during those extraordinary circumstances of the pandemic is not surprising. The other factor, too, is with a lot of people working from home, the various closing of public places, which are almost universally smoke-free environments, a lot of people were spending much more time at home where, unless they chose to have restrictions on it, there really weren't limits on smoking in particular, where environmental tobacco smoke is a concern. So again, another factor that may well have led people who were already using cigarettes and other tobacco to increase their consumption in 2020.
I should flip things around and look at the 20 years of good news, declining use of tobacco products. What's behind some of that success story?
Well, I think it's a combination of a number of things. Big one being that we have effective ways to help people quit smoking. It's no longer just, years ago when I started doing this, really the only option people had was throw away your cigarettes and tough it out cold turkey, especially for that first week, which is when the vast majority of people would go back to smoking. We now have effective evidence-based treatments. They reduce withdrawal. They reduce the craving. They make it much less unpleasant for people than quitting cold turkey. There's also, though, been a lot of social changes that have augmented that, in that there are so many environments now where smoking in particular, less so for smokeless tobacco, but smoking is not allowed to protect the health of people in the environment. And of course, the social perspective on smoking has changed too, from something that was incredibly commonplace. It was not that long ago that it wasn't uncommon to have healthcare workers in clinics and hospitals lighting up right there. And these days, that's basically inconceivable. And we've also had an increase in effective prevention programs too. And I think you really see that in terms of young people choosing not to start using tobacco in the first place.
That strikes me. I was in the hospital once when I was in high school, and I had to be moved out of my hospital room because my roommate was smoking, the person in the other bed in the room.
Wow. And
you don't see that anymore, do you?
No, not at all. And, it seems like a long time ago, but it was only the mid-1990s. No, and didn't mean to imply, but from a policy point of view, it was only the mid-1990s that the Joint Commission on Healthcare Facilities actually came out and said hospitals and clinics really need to be smoke free. Otherwise, we're sending a very negative mixed message to people who are seeking to improve their health.
Talking to Dr. Doug Jorenby with the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, looking at tobacco rates, tobacco use rates in the U.S., going down for 20 years, an uptick in cigarette sales this last year, though. So we're going to call her at 800-642-1234. Barry is with us now in Madison. Barry, hi.
Hi, Dr. Jorenby. Hi, I remember you from the UW, Tobacco Research Center. I quit again with the patch, 21 milligram, and I had to cut a sock in half and put it on my shoulder to hold it on, and I'm dealing with a lot of stress. And I was wondering, what's the best way to handle stress?
Interesting. Thanks, Barry. So he's got the patch, which is all with the nicotine side of thing. But how about that stress? That's part of the solution, right, Dr. Jorenby?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, of course, it varies from person to person what that stress is coming from and what kind of things people have to deal with it. But, great creative problem solving there, Barry, with the sock. I love that one. I'll have to file that away for future reference. The big thing is, there are a lot of different things that people use to help them cope with stress, whether it's leaving situations, whether it's doing some deep breathing to calm themselves down if they're feeling really anxious, whether it's taking action to address the cause of the stress rather than just keeping it at bay at the length of a cigarette. The important thing, I think, for people to remember to take away from that is that they don't have to be helpless in the face of stress if they stop smoking. People who have never smoked do all kinds of things to deal with stress on a regular basis. It's just for a lot of people who start smoking, particularly as teenagers, it's just been so convenient. It's a go-to, and they've never really had the opportunity to learn some of the other stress coping techniques that people who have never smoked use all the time.
Thanks a lot for that call, Barry. We'll go now to Lissy in Green Bay. Lissy, hi.
Hi. Thank you, Rob, and thank you to your guests for being on today. I just wanted to say I've been a smoker since high school, unfortunately, and my schedule didn't really change too much over COVID, but I will say my smoking definitely increased, whether it was out of just, everybody else's things going on or, the stress levels or just clearly out of boredom.
Okay, and she's, I'm guessing, not alone, Dr. Jorenby, smoking more just because of that, the weird year, the boredom and the stress.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, and that's something I should have mentioned up front. But yeah, boredom actually can be a major source of stress for people, and again, it's a go-to for a lot of people. That's a cue to pick up a cigarette and start puffing away when you feel bored, even though we don't always necessarily think of it as being stressful in the same way. But, certainly there was plenty of boredom to go along with things too, when people couldn't go to their, their typical restaurant or the bar or to go out to see a movie, all the other things that we use to distract ourselves from feeling bored in normal circumstances.
Thanks for that call and good luck to you, Lissy. We're talking to Dr. Doug Jorenby from the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, looking at an uptick in cigarette sales over the last year after 20 years of going down. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you've got a question or experience you'd like to share. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation and get a look at a local prevention effort here in Wisconsin that's coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk about tobacco use during the pandemic. Dr. Doug Jorenby is with us, Director of Clinical Services for the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Now we're going to take a closer look at a local prevention effort in Milwaukee. Lorraine Lathan is the founder and president of Jump at the Sun Consultants, an organization that administers the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention and Poverty Network. Lorraine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about tobacco as an issue of special concern in Milwaukee, especially among Black and low-income communities?
Yes, I can. Just wanted to kind of share with you that we know that tobacco is an addiction, and we know that there are tobacco disparities. When you look at African-Americans, when you look at people, low-income populations, the rate of tobacco use is much higher. In fact, for African Americans, it's almost twice that of the state average. It's at 25%, whereas the state is at 16%. And clearly with the pandemic, there's been lots of stressors that have triggered even more tobacco use within the communities that we serve. So what we've done is we've really tried to encourage people who have quit to stay quit. And part of that is looking at what their triggers are and having a plan of action of how to deal with those triggers. It could be exercise, it could be not hanging out with others that smoke, not hanging out the bars, but really having a plan to deal with triggers. So that's one of the things that we've been doing. The way we function is we work with and for the community. We do quite a bit of work in public housing and with residents in general. So we have subcommittees that have focused on helping people, educating people around tobacco and knowing that tobacco is the cause of the three leading causes of deaths for African-Americans, which is heart disease, cancer, and stroke. So we want people to know that. We want people to have the tools to be able to quit smoking, at least to initiate that quit journey. And some of the things we've had to do with the pandemic is we've had to provide support virtually via Zoom versus in person. We recently will be launching a campaign that deals with COVID and smoking and how COVID actually it's a good time to quit smoking because of the pandemic. And so that campaign has been developed by public housing residents. It's a social media campaign to provide people with support so that they can quit smoking. Those are just a few of the activities that we're engaged in. We have worked very hard to address the issue of menthol. Mm-hmm. We know that mentholated tobacco products, they're easier to start and more difficult to quit. And they're smoked more often by African-Americans and or people, low-income populations. And so we've done a lot around educating around menthol. We know young people that they certainly had become addicted to mentholated tobacco products. So we've been working with our faith-based partners. We have No Menthol Sunday, which is nationwide, where we have our pastors really just sharing from the pulpit the harms of tobacco, the harms of menthol, and a number of activities that occur. Now, we started that years ago in Milwaukee. It has expanded throughout the state of Wisconsin. So we're pleased to be part of that movement to educate. And I guess the only other thing I'd want to share with you with, again, going back to the pandemic, when you look at some of the communities where you see tobacco addiction at much higher rates than the general population, we started to notice a few things. We started to notice that there are more tobacco retailers in those communities, sometimes two times as many more retailers, and sometimes depending on the zip code or the census tract, could be as many as three to five times more retailers. And we also noticed that there's more tobacco retailers within 500 feet of schools, playgrounds, and youth serving organizations. So we've been working with our community to mobilize them to educate on these are also triggers as well. You know, if you're trying to stop and you're seeing advertising all over the place, when you go to pay for gas, when you run to the convenience store, and the advertising for tobacco is prominently displayed and you're trying to quit, that creates barriers. So our network is working with the community to try to change some of even just the zoning around the advertising that is occurring, price promotions that occur more often in our communities than in the suburbs as well. So this is just a few kind of examples of the work that we've been doing. And we certainly, when the pandemic started, we called some of the people that had gone through some of the smoking cessation programs that we have supported. We called them, we did kind of wellness phone calls to just say, okay, how are you doing? How's your quitting journey? How is that working for you? Do you think you need to modify your plan, in terms of how to deal with triggers? So a lot of just trying to provide support and outreach. And we always encourage people when they feel they're going to relapse to call 1-800-QUIT-NOW, which is our state quit line number, which also provides quit aids as well.
And Lorraine, I wanted to ask you, you've got this community-focused approach, as you mentioned, reaching out personally to people. If there are people around the state who think, yeah, we see a lot of smoking here, what would you suggest to them, just in our last minute with you, to start up a program like that on their own?
Yes. So I would suggest that they reach out to us. They can contact us at waatpn.org. And we can certainly support them. We have all kinds of materials. And it can start, I would encourage people even to start with a small group, and they can grow that group. It's all about supporting one another as they're trying to quit. So we have the tools. We have the information. They are welcome to reach out to us.
Lorraine, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
That's Lorraine Lathan. She administers the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention and Poverty Network through her organization Jump at the Sun's Consultants. Let's bring Dr. Doug Jornby back into the conversation now. A lot there to follow up on, Dr. Jornby. First of all, the value of a local community-based effort like she was telling us about.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ms. Lathan and her team have just done some really important work over the years, making use of those personal community connections. And particularly for people who historically haven't had good access to quality health care, that's absolutely critical in overcoming disparities, because we know, as she mentioned, that tobacco use is not an equal opportunity dependence. It really hits hardest at the people that have the least income, the least education, the least opportunity.
She also mentioned the menthol cigarette issue, which I know the Federal Trade Commission has started tracking the numbers of menthol cigarette sales. How big a part of the story is that?
I think it's an increasing one, and it was very interesting to see the emphasis that the Federal Trade Commission placed on menthol. It's kind of going in parallel with what we see the Food and Drug Administration doing with vaping products, where they've signaled very strongly that flavors of any kind, with the possible exception of menthol, are just going to be complete non-starters because of the evidence that's amassed with vaping and e-cigarettes, how appealing those are to young people and get them started in using nicotine that often goes on to tobacco. So I think it's not a coincidence that the emphasis you mentioned was there. And that also spills over into some novel products like nicotine pouches that don't contain tobacco at all, but is something that the FDA is going to have to come to grips with as they move into the market in the U.S.
And the issue of advertising, especially concentrated in higher risk communities, and the concentration of retailers in at-risk communities. Do you think steps need to be taken to deal with those?
I think the numbers that Ms. Lathan mentioned just speak for themselves. It's just when you stop to look at the prevalence of vending outlets and advertising and proximity to schools in low-income neighborhoods versus more affluent neighborhoods, it just jumps out at you. It's a far more significant change than the less than a percentage point increase in uptake we were talking about earlier. And I think it's something, as communities become more aware of it, they realize that that this is a deliberate strategy that's being followed and not necessarily one that they need to go along with.
And for people, Dr. Jornby, who are still smoking and want to quit, or maybe even saw that uptick or going back to smoking during the pandemic, what kind of resources do we have here in Wisconsin to help them out?
We have a great one, which is the Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line. It's available at no cost to anyone in the state. Folks can access that through the web or by calling 1-800-QUITNOW, Quit Now. And they provide counseling through telephone, through texts. They also can provide people with up to 2 weeks of over-the-counter nicotine replacement therapy like patches or lozenges or gum, as we were talking about earlier, that help reduce withdrawal and craving and can increase people's chances of quitting successfully on the order of 2 to 3 times when you combine those factors.
And just briefly, Dr. Jornby, I think it's something to emphasize. You hear from people who tried once to quit, it didn't take, and they feel like, well, I can't do it. It's very common that it takes more than one try, right?
It's extremely common. And what we find is people learn. They learn from their experience, and they get better at quitting. So, yes, if someone's tried, not been totally successful, take what you learned from that last attempt and bring that forward into the next time. There are better and worse times, but there's never a bad time to quit tobacco.
Dr. Jornby, thanks again for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
That's Dr. Doug Jornby, Director of Clinical Services at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention and Professor of Medicine at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Join us for a look at the impact of the pandemic on cigarette sales and tobacco use. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and Dori Greenspan is going to be back with us. She's got a new book, cookbook, full of great baking advice. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll find out how Wisconsin residents feel about Governor Evers, Senator Johnson, and President Biden, and on a bunch of issues that are in the news right now. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, 5 to 11-year-olds can now get the COVID-19 vaccine after a decision from federal health officials yesterday. We talked to the head of the State Department of Health Services about the rollout here in Wisconsin. First, if the midterm elections were today, Wisconsin might be electing a new governor and a new U.S. senator. According to yesterday's Marquette University Law School poll, 40% said they'd vote for Democratic Governor Tony Evers, 53% for somebody else. And only 38% said they'd vote for Republican Senator Ron Johnson. 52% said someone else. Among the other highlights, slightly more than half say Wisconsin is going in the wrong direction. About 2/3 say they're very concerned about inflation. 4 in 10 say the same about COVID-19. The poll also got into redistricting, immigration, abortion, and other issues. There's a lot there. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. It's early, but do you plan on voting for Governor Evers? How about Senator Johnson? Are you not sure? Which issues are the most important to you in the state? And as you look ahead to elections, how do you feel about who should draw Wisconsin's legislative maps? How about COVID vaccination mandates? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette University Law School poll and a professor of law and public policy. He's also co-founder of pollster.com and founder of pollsandvotes.com. Charles, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, some bad news for key statewide elected offices for both parties here. Governor Evers, Senator Johnson, not getting great results no matter how you slice it, right?
No, I think that's right. I think the things you summarized earlier, sort of the big takeaways, is voters are somewhat grumpy. They're not excited about the direction the state, or for that matter, the country is headed. And it's showing up in Governor Evers' job approval, which is at 45 approve, 46 disapprove. That's the first time he's been underwater on that measure for a while, though it's very close. But that's down from 50 approve in August and 43 disapprove. So there is a notable drop in his approval ratings. Likewise, on the reelect numbers, since it's not at all clear yet who the candidates are going to be, we asked this question in the form of, would you vote to reelect Evers or Johnson, or would you vote for somebody else? So Evers at 40% reelect, Johnson at 38, both of them over 50% vote for someone else, is showing that they have a base of support that they can probably count on, but that base is well short of 50%. Now, whenever you offer somebody the known incumbent against somebody else, voters can imagine the most wonderful somebody else in the world. And so this is not in any way a projection of where the election would turn out, but it gives us a way of looking at the foundations of support for Evers and Johnson. Both are still holding on to their partisans pretty well and are being massively opposed by the other party. But among independents, they're not doing that well, and that's one of the reasons we see them a little weak on this measure.
Now, I kept scrolling through looking for the person or institution that people in Wisconsin had an overall favorable approval rating for. I keep scrolling all day, right, and not find that.
You could scroll till next month. We asked about seven different political figures of both parties, and for the first time in 67 polls that we've done, not one of them was more favorable than unfavorable. Now, that ranged from just a little underwater. Tammy Baldwin was at 38 favorable, 39 unfavorable, so just a one-point difference there, to much more considerable unfavorable balance, Trump at 38 favorable, 57 unfavorable. But it's still striking that that was true of both parties and president, a former president, two vice presidents we asked about, and Governor Evers. So really, really, this is back to the voters are a little grumpy right now, and they're really not enthused at the moment with any of their political leaders.
Right, because a lot of times you might say, oh, Democrats are doing better now and Republicans are doing worse, or Republicans are doing better, Democrats are doing worse. Have you seen this kind of everybody's not looking so pretty? You said it's been a long time, or never, you've seen everybody underwater like that.
Right. And, you know, part of it is that there's usually been one particular person who's pretty popular, and so that's part of the story. But I think it's surprising that if I told you ahead of time that Tony Evers was at 40% reelect, given the polarization of the state, you might think, well, therefore, Ron Johnson must be at 60% reelect, right? It must be just a partisan split. But instead, we see them both, Evers at 40, Johnson at 38. That's what's telling you that they're not doing that well with independents, because, again, they're both holding on to their bases at least pretty well. But independents are not in a mood to back either of these two incumbents at this point. And again, we have a full year to go. In fact, a good perspective is look back to 2015. Ron Johnson in 2015 had his lowest net favorability ratings in the history of the polling until now, but crept back, getting more and more popular all the way through the 2016 election cycle, and converted a summer trailing in the polls to getting better and better and better, and ultimately beats Russ Feingold in November of 2016. So this is why we keep polling between now and November, but it's also why you want to keep an eye on these things and see how they track over time. Maybe people will get more optimistic about politicians in the country. Maybe they'll get worse. And maybe partisan advantage will start to show up Whereas what right now what we're seeing is both parties seem to be not faring that well, especially with independents.
Talking to Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll, about their latest survey of Wisconsin. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Catherine is with us in Milwaukee. Catherine, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Catherine?
Well, I wanted to say I'm 1,000% behind Evers because he is doing his job. And I have to tell you, I'm quite sick of all this early polling. What we need to do is be educating the electorate to be responsible citizens. It's too fickle what you're polling about. And in the time, I mean, I don't care about partisanship and division. I care about issues and concern of the electorate. And this is why the country is in so much trouble. We're focused on media highlighting division rather than what is our responsibility to our families, to our children, to our country in governing. And the issue for me is we have so many people, Ron Johnson among them, who don't believe in government. And so, but they want to be in these positions to control the people who do.
Catherine, thanks for the call. Charles, we can get into some of the issues you polled on earlier, but what do you think of that idea that reporting these polls in kind of stark terms may reinforce some of our partisan divide?
Well, you'll be surprised to know that as a pollster, I believe polling has a value to contribute. So I'm afraid Catherine and I are not going to agree on that one. I would encourage her and everyone to look at the poll results because you ran down, what, close to a dozen of the issues we asked about. And I want to stress that this poll has many more questions about public policy issues than it has about horse races. And so it's natural that we start talking about the horse race and about the candidates' favorability and that sort of thing. But we have a lot of questions on here, and, you know, I'm afraid that they're often lost in the conversation and, you know, the limited amount of time that we have to talk about them. I'd also push back on this point that if we don't have polling, the only people who are going to tell you what the public thinks are going to be the self-interested politicians and interest groups who pay for their own private polling and then talk about it. So, again, in the defense of pollsters here, we're trying our best to give an even-handed look at public opinion that's not coming from parties or politicians or interest groups.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's look at one of the issues you polled on. You asked people, this is a hot topic with the WPR podcast that's sweeping the state mapped out. Redistricting. You asked people what they thought about how we draw the lines that determine who represents what district. What did you find out?
Well, for the third time in 3 years, we find that over 60% would prefer that redistricting be done by a nonpartisan commission. Just 25% think the legislature and governor should do it, and about 15% say they don't know. We've asked this question in 2019, in 2020, and now we've asked it again, and it's been over 60% each time. I think the most striking figure about this, though, is that support for nonpartisan districting is at 62% among Republicans, 63% with independents, and 64% with Democrats. That is a stunningly even distribution of support for nonpartisan districting, regardless of people's partisanship. But it contrasts starkly with the partisan divisions over the actual process of redistricting that we're seeing. The other side of this is that as important as redistricting is, and as much as it's been talked about and as much as activists have been involved with it, only 39% say they're following the process closely or fairly closely, and 60% say not too much or not at all. So the problem of the public not being engaged on the issue is also part of why we don't see any change in the process of districting.
We're finding out how Wisconsin residents feel about key political figures and key issues. Charles Franklin is with us, a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University, director there of the Marquette University Law School poll. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the job our elected officials are doing in general or particular ones? Is Wisconsin, is the country on the right or wrong track? And which issue do you follow most closely? The economy, COVID, education, immigration, redistricting? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, hear from some more of you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the latest findings in yesterday's Marquette University Law School poll, asking how Wisconsin voters feel about Governor Evers, Senator Johnson, President Biden, and more, plus issues including immigration, inflation, COVID-19, and more. Charles Franklin is with us, director of that poll. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Torsten is with us in Janesville. Torsten, hi.
Hi. I have a question about that private polling that you were kind of just referencing. I got a call just a couple days ago asking me if I wanted to do a political survey, and so I started it, and everything seemed normal, and then the questions started to skew more and more, and it felt like the questions were trying to influence my answers. And by the end, I asked, you know, where did this poll come from, and said something about the Republican something or other, and it made me wonder, what's the difference between a poll that's being funded by a partisan group like that and a private poll, and how can I know the difference as somebody who's getting the phone call, and then how those results are being used in media?
That's a great question. Thank you. There are two ways, or let's say three ways. One is some calls that masquerade as polls are really advertising polls trying to push you, and we call those push polls. I don't think that sounds like what you heard the other day. Campaigns and parties often do what they call message testing within the poll. And in that, they sort of state the best case for that candidate, maybe the worst case against the other candidate, or even they test their own weaknesses and the other guy's strengths, other candidate's strengths. Those are, within the polling profession, seen as perfectly legitimate things to try to ask, because you do want to know how voters react to particular messages or positions. But from the point of view of you as a respondent, it may very much sound like they're trying to influence your opinion, because in a sense they are, to find out what influences you, not that they're really trying to change your position in a permanent way. So it's very, very hard as the innocent respondent at home to know the difference. I will say, to their credit, when you asked who was doing the poll, they apparently gave you at least an indication of it. State law requires pollsters to say who their sponsors are. But for a lot of polls done for political purposes, they'll give you the name of the organization, but it's something nondescript, and no one would know who that is and who they're working for. And that's a problem, I think. For nonpartisan polls, media polls, or university polls like mine, the very first things we say when we call is, I'm calling on behalf of Marquette University. And so you know right up front that it's us calling. But if you're a campaign, you don't want to call and say, I'm calling on behalf of the Evers campaign or on behalf of the Johnson campaign, because that could obviously skew your results. So this is a problem with polling and what is revealed to the respondent and what's not.
Torsten, thanks for the call. Going out to John in Luck. John, hello.
Hello. Hello.
Yep. What'd you want to bring up, John?
I'm of an age where I remember the silent majority, and I'm wondering about either the Republicans or the Democrats if these negative numbers at 38% really just reflect the base, the bases that have solidified, and in this case, high negatives, and what is driving the outcomes are what we used to call in the old days the silent majority, who may be moving, because the results, not only in Wisconsin but in the Virginia and New Jersey, for example, on Tuesday, There was a massive swing, and it sounds to me like it's those people that the pollsters don't get, or that who are independent, and we don't hear about them as much.
John, thanks. The silent majority, the thought that, hey, maybe there are some people out there that we aren't measuring well enough who surprise us on Election Day, Charles.
No, I think that's a good point. And, you know, pointing to Virginia and New Jersey is a terrific point, because Biden won those states pretty handily by 6 or 7, I think, in Virginia, by 16 or so in New Jersey. And you get, you know, swings of 7 to maybe as much as 15 or so percent in those two. That is a great example that looking at the last election and believing this election will be just like that is really wrong. What we have in our data is about 40% who say they're independents, though of those, only about 9% say they're independent and don't lean towards either party. But that 9% can be a critical balance in a state that's divided, in our data, again, 30% Republican to 29% Democratic. We're right on the knife's edge there. And so 9% can make a difference. If you also look at those people that are independents and lean to a party, most of the time they vote with that party. That's true. But they don't vote as loyally as pure partisans. So in one sense, their votes are up for grabs too. It's just that maybe among that group, they only go 75% with the party they lean to instead of 85% with that party. But there, again, is enough movement to make a difference. And in Wisconsin, 4 of the last 6 presidential races were decided by under a single percentage point. The governor's race was decided by 1.1 percentage points in 2018. So I think there's lots of room for swing at the margin. And then finally, there's the thing of turnout. A mobilized electorate can make up for a lot if the mobilization is on one side.
Thanks for that call. I want to check out a couple more issues before we run out of time. One concern about inflation. What did you find out when you asked people about that?
Inflation concern is quite high and getting higher. 64% said they were very concerned about it, and another 28% somewhat concerned. So that puts us up to 92% significantly concerned. And that's up from August when it was 49% very concerned. So this is an issue that hasn't been before us for really several decades. But now it's back and it is definitely getting the public's attention. An obvious question is how long it continues to see significant inflation. And inflation of all the economic issues is the one that every citizen experiences when they fill up their gas tank or go to the grocery store or buy their kids' clothes. So it can be a potent issue. And right now it's one with really a lot of concern in the public.
And the U.S. Supreme Court hearing an abortion case earlier this week, another one coming up next month. You asked about abortion briefly, and just our last, we've got a minute. What did you find out?
61% say abortion should be legal in most or all situations. 34% say it should be illegal in most or all cases. We've asked this question 11 different times since 2012, and it hasn't moved by more than a couple of percentage points from poll to poll, with no trend up or down for either side of the abortion issue.
And, just a few moments left. How about immigration?
Immigration concern, illegal immigration, has risen slightly. It's at 43% very concerned, up from 37 in August, well behind inflation, but still pretty significant. And concern about COVID is at 40% very concerned. So there you see the pandemic maybe dropping behind these other two issues as top concerns for the public.
Charles, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Rob.
That's Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University, director of the Marquette University Law School poll. We talked to him about the survey that came out yesterday. It shows only about 40% of registered voters would vote to reelect Governor Evers, they say, and just 38% say that about Senator Johnson. Coming up after the news, the head of the State Department of Health Services joins us to talk about COVID vaccines for kids, booster shots, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.